Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For most of human history, we have either hunted or scared away the rest of the animal kingdom, the primary exceptions, I suppose, being those that we domesticate, raise for food, and watch for at the backyard feeder. Noted naturalist and best-selling author Cy Montgomery likes to go deeper and farther flung, looking for something we might recognize in the most unlikely of creatures. Her latest book is entitled The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration in the Wonder of Consciousness. Cy Montgomery joins us today in the studio, and we welcome you back to the show, Cy.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to be back here.
Cy Montgomery will be speaking at the Ohio State University Fawcett Center at 7 p.m. about her new book, with a question and answer period after that and a book signing to follow. If you want more information, check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Cy, most people, as you know, are sort of grossed out at best and fearful at least of octopuses. Where does that fear come from? What do we know about why that is and the suggestion that they're monsters? Where does that come from?
Well, I think it's because a giant Pacific octopus is a pretty impressive beast. I mean, here's somebody who can weigh 300 pounds. They can have an arm span. The largest recorded, I think, was 32 feet. You know, they're boneless creatures covered with slime. They have powerful suckers. And they look so different from us that I think, you know, we fear what's that different. And we fear things in the sea. The sea, kind of like the subconscious, contains all kinds of things, all kinds of mysteries that we know little about. And I think this makes people afraid of them.
When you're quoting others who have written about them, Victor Hugo, for example, they seem to get the octopus all wrong. Were they just guessing?
Well, I think it's good fodder for a monster. You know, you would have to go into outer space or science fiction to come up with a creature more unlike us than an octopus, right? And being covered with slime is another thing that makes people unhappy, although slime is a good thing, right? I mean, without slime, two of the greatest pleasures known to man would not be possible, one of which is eating.
You referred to the idea set forth by the French philosopher René Descartes in 1637, that only people think. Right. And that has had a profound impact on how we think about other species. And it's something that you try to rectify in all of your work.
Absolutely. I mean, that whole philosophy, je pense, donc je suis, I think, therefore I am. And the idea that permitted these like horrible vivisection experiments. People would say as the animals screamed in pain, oh, it's just a machine that's producing that noise in response to that stimulus. We know that's not true. We now know through all kinds of scientific experiments, some of them quite cruel, that animals are wired just like we are, which is why, ironically, we use animals in our medical experiments, because they are so like us. And it makes sense, because we're all, you know, if you accept the overwhelming evolution, you know, the evidence for evolution, you know, we didn't come up with a nervous system de novo. We did not come up with neurotransmitters out of nowhere. We share the same neurotransmitters that give us our emotions, that give us fear and love and a desire for companionship. They're the same across many, many species. We now know this beyond a doubt. But old ideas die hard. And it's quite convenient for humans to say, we're the only species that matters. I mean, we've done this even with, you know, men are the only ones that matter, or white people are the only ones that matter, or Europeans are the only ones that matter. But I think it's much more welcoming and makes us feel more whole to be part of a larger world, part of a larger family of creatures who all think and feel much as we do.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Cy Montgomery, author of The Soul of an Octopus, a surprising exploration into the wonder of consciousness. If you have a question or comment for Cy Montgomery, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page. I think there should be a photo of Cy and me on the Facebook page by now, and check that out and post your question or comment there. The last time you were on the show was after you'd written the book Birdology. And at that time, about that time, there was the YouTube sensation Snowball, the dancing parakeet.
Cockatoo.
Cockatoo, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we talked about that at the time a little bit. It was easy to sort of sublimate make little or light of it that, oh, it's just a machine, kind of. It's just doing something that it's seen before, done before. But when you looked at Snowball, you'd say, no, he's got the beat.
Oh, yeah. And a neuroscientist has actually done studies on Snowball. And you know what? I did a children's book on Snowball,
yeah.
Which proceeds of which benefit the bird rescue.
What's the name of that book?
It's called Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo.
Oh, okay.
And it's from Bowen Publishers.
Okay.
And it benefits bird lovers only, bird rescue. But the cool thing is, you know, they found that he was sinking to the beat. And this is an attribute of higher minds to be able to do this. And it was thought, of course, that only humans could do it. But probably a number of animals can do it. And Ani Patel, this wonderful neuroscientist who is now in Boston, is studying this with great interest. We also know that birds can answer us meaningfully in English. And like us, they like to parrot things. I mean, how many lyrics do you sing that you don't really know what they really mean, you know? I mean, for years, I thought Tiny Dancer was Tony Danza and that, what was it called, Half Breed was Hair Freak. So, but you sing them anyway. And birds they like the sound of stuff. But there are birds like Irene Pepperberg's parrot, the African gray named Alex, who we know speaks meaningfully. You can ask him what color when you point to an object on a tray, and he'll say green, and how many, and he'll say four, and you'll put two and three, and you'll say how many, and he'll add them and come up with five, and he'll tell you stuff. So we know that they can tell us about their lives.
And improbably, so can octopuses.
Yes. We can read some of what they're thinking on their skin. And they show us, for instance, that octopuses recognize individual humans just from looking up at them from beneath the water, even if those humans are dressed identically. And that's an experiment that was conducted by Dr. Jennifer Mather and Roland Anderson of the Seattle Aquarium. She's with Lethbridge University. She did these experiments in which volunteers wearing identical shirts were asked to either touch an octopus with a bristly stick, which they don't like, or feed them consistently. And very quickly, the octopuses learned to move towards those who had fed them. And for those who had touched them with the bristly stick, they would either move away or sometimes blast them in the face with icy cold water from their jets.
Fight back a little bit. But also, there was, I think in your book you mentioned that even when someone didn't have a bristly stick after a while, they would recognize
absolutely.
That was
the person
that
looking
had
up
had
at
it.
You. Yeah, just looking up at you, they would remember, oh, that's the guy who touched me with the bristly stick, and move away.
Here's one issue about octopuses that we should raise right off the bat, and you do in your book right off the bat, and that's how to refer to them in the plural.
Oh, right. Now, I grew up thinking it was octopi.
Just like the rest of us.
Right. Applepuss, apple pie, octopus, apple. But it turns out that you're not supposed to do that because octopus is a Greek word. And the I ending for plural is a Latin ending. So the octopus police will come out if you say octopi. If you're in the know, you'll say octopuses.
octopuses. Now you know. You wrote that you've always harbored a fondness for monsters, rooting for Godzilla and King Kong. And I've always been the same way, too. And what is that about us that we – what do you make of that? And then, therefore, rooting for the octopus.
Well, you know, I think, like you, that folks like us have always been interested in the other. And we've always wanted to see the good side and suspected that there's another side to that story. So I have so been attracted to other minds, and I've been immensely rewarded. Every time I've investigated another mind, it turns out to be a thrilling, surprising, revelatory experience. And I bet you've had the same.
Well, nothing like you. I only get it from reading your books.
Oh,
but because people don't have the sort of access that you had, nor should they. I mean, because a lot of these animals, being what they are, they're somewhat fragile. And I was surprised at how fragile the octopus is.
Well, they're fragile but strong, too.
Right.
But the thing, they're fragile in that their skin is very similar to our stomach in that it's really permeable to stuff. So they can very easily be poisoned by toxins in the water. And they're super vulnerable to that. But they also have amazing powers and super strength. A single sucker, 2.5 inches in diameter, can lift 30 pounds.
That's amazing.
And a giant Pacific octopus, one of 250 species, has 1,600 of those suckers.
Do they know their own strength?
Yes, they do. They also have a very fine grip with those suckers. An octopus can take out stitching, surgical silk. And this is a problem if an octopus needs an operation and your vet stitches it up very carefully. In the morning, you'll find that the octopus has taken it all out and all the silk is.
And you can't use a cone of shame with an octopus.
No, you can't, which is too bad because, like, where's their neck? You know, it's not where you think. Most people, I mean, this is how alien they are. We go head, body, limbs. They go body, head, limbs. And so that big thing that most people think is the head, it's not. It's the body containing most of the organs. Their head's actually pretty small. And their brain wraps around their throat. They're just built so differently.
It's about the size of a walnut, you said?
Yeah, although it's not shaped like a walnut.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah. And I was thinking maybe they're so – I mean, we're always talking about brain size. And one thing they tell us is humans don't use but a fraction of their brain. And I wonder, maybe animals use more of their brains.
Well, and also anything could be miniaturized, as
right.
we know from computers. They
right.
used to be the size of a room and now you put it in your pocket. So brain size isn't as big a deal as we used to think. And because we tend to look for stuff that looks like us, when we look at other creatures' brains and we say, oh, that doesn't look like mine, we're making a big mistake to dismiss that. Birds, for example, for the longest time, birds don't have anything that looks like our frontal cortex. And our frontal cortex is where most of our thinking occurs. So people dismissed birds as not having thoughts. Well, now we know that they have an equivalent of our frontal cortex. We just couldn't recognize it. And if you look at an octopus brain, it's way different from ours. Ours has four lobes. Theirs is shaped like a ring, and it has somewhere between 50 to 75 lobes, depending on the species and how you count the lobes. So short of an alien showing up, you know, from outer space, there's nothing more unlike us, and they're great mysteries.
And beyond that, they have neurons throughout their legs, is it?
Yeah, they're, you know, most of our neurons are in our brains.
Right.
But 3/5 of theirs are in their arms. So what does this mean for who the octopus is? Do they have multiple selves? I mean, we don't know. But this was why I wanted to do my investigation in a whole different way than anyone had ever done before. I mean, sure, I went to the scientific literature, and I worked with some of the top scientists. I went to Moria with Dr. Jennifer Mather and Dr. David Scheele and Dr. Tatiana Leite, and interviewed all kinds of people, and I did all that. But I wanted to use my heart as a tool of inquiry. I wanted to have a relationship, to make a friend out of an octopus. And I ended up befriending four octopuses, getting to know them and their personalities very well. And they knew me. They clearly recognized me. They would look me in the face. They would come over to greet me. And when I would put my arms into the water with them, their arms would come boiling up to meet mine, and they would cover my skin with their suckers. And I would pet them, and their skin would change color with my touch. And I got to know how distinctive they can be, how they have personalities as distinctive as ours. And that, to me, was utterly revelatory.
I'm talking with Cy Montgomery. Her new book is called The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness. Cy Montgomery will be speaking at the Ohio State University Fawcett Center at 7 p.m. about her new book, with a Q&A to follow and a book signing. So if you want to learn more about that, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about octopuses today. And there's a lot of good reasons to talk about octopuses, especially when the guest talking about them is Cy Montgomery, the noted naturalist, a prolific author. Her new book is entitled The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness. Once again, Cy Montgomery, thanks for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be back.
There was something that you said that really struck me in your book, and I wanted to pick up on that after what you were just saying. You made an interesting observation upon meeting Athena, an octopus at the New England Aquarium, where you spent a lot of time researching for this book. You wrote, "She is at once touching and tasting my skin and possibly the muscle, bone, and blood beneath. Though we have only just met, Athena already knows me in a way no being has known me before." And that really struck me because we've been talking about how the human nature to feel like we're the top of the food chain, we're the best and nothing else matters. And that was an interesting observation to me, that she knows you in a way that no one else can.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, all around us are creatures who know us and know the world in a different way than we can know them or others. For example, you know, birds see polarized light. They can see colors that we don't experience. To a hummingbird, the world is glittering and glorious in a way that we can't imagine. And they experience time in a different way. Dogs, you know your dog is experiencing a world of scent that we will never have. And, you know, Henry Beston, the wonderful naturalist who wrote The Outermost House, I think said it best in that, you know, they are not brethren, they are not underlings, they are other nations caught with us in the net of life and time, living by voices we will never hear. And when you have an interaction with another species, you have a way of touching that other world that is our world, but it's a reality that's beside our reality. And we expand our reality. We expand our universe vastly when you reach out with that hand and touch these other species. And this book, getting to know the octopuses who I got to know as friends, I got to enter the real world in a way I never had before. Most of our Earth is water. 70% of the surface is water. 90% of the habitable space is water. And the vast majority of living animals are invertebrates. And yet we know so little about them. These octopuses opened for me the entire sea. And now I'm like on an odyssey that is never going to end. And I've learned scuba diving. My next book is on great white sharks. I got to go cage diving with sharks for that. And through the New England Aquarium, the people there, I met people, the most amazing people, who could see electric eels dreaming and smell fish stress. Yeah. And this isn't just stuff I made up. I mean, this is proven. This whole other world exists.
And to on a more simple note, just like we do make friends walking dogs, you make friends when you unite in a purpose of another being.
Absolutely. And it's very real. It is not made up. It is not anthropomorphizing. I'm going to talk about that tonight in my lecture. Everyone who talks about animals having thoughts and feelings, someone is going to say, you're anthropomorphizing. Anthropomorphizing means projecting human feelings onto animals. One, projecting human feelings sounds like humans are the only ones who have feelings, and that's just scientifically wrong. It's easy, though, even with humans, to project a wrong feeling onto somebody, so that certainly is possible. But claiming that only humans have thoughts and feelings is to deny both the fact of evolution and every religion that ever existed who tells us that we share a common creator with everybody else. Who doesn't want to be part of that family? I want to be part of that family.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Can we go through a few factoids about octopuses? For instance, their life cycle. What's it like? How does it differ from ours?
Well, they live fast and die young. The giant Pacific probably has the longest life of any of the 250 species, and alas, they only live 3 to 5 years. They hatch out of an egg the size of a grain of rice, and within a few years, they're as big as a man.
That is if they survive being
right,
consumed
all of these
by
predators.
Who knows what. Right.
That's right. And when they hatch out, they're part of the plankton, the drifting life that keeps the world alive, you know, and everybody eats plankton. And an octopus is a mollusk, as you know, but most mollusks have a shell to protect them, but the octopus doesn't. But what the octopus has to protect it is its really big, smart brain. And they have all of these amazing superpower defenses. They have a beak like a parrot. They have venom like a snake. They have ink that they can shoot. They can change color and shape. They can pour themselves into a tiny opening.
They move things around.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They go out looking for stuff. I mean, there's a video that people might want to access on the internet of a coconut octopus. They call it a coconut octopus. This octopus goes out and searches for two halves of a coconut, gathers it up, carries it in its front arms, then strides purposefully on its back arms to the place it wants. And it's using the shells, by the way, as a shield for its vulnerable body, because there's all kinds of creatures who lurk beneath the sand who can shoot up and eat you. So it's protecting it like a shield until it gets to where it wants to go to sleep. Then it reassembles the two halves of the coconut, gets inside, and now he's in a nice little shelter.
They do the same thing with rocks if they find a little cave or something like that.
Yes, they'll gather rocks. They'll go out searching for just the right rocks, carry them back to their den. They also, some of them will garden in front of their den. They'll use their dens for a period of, it could be days or weeks depending on the species. But they'll even, they'll clear away some of the vegetation. They'll clip the hedges in front of their little homes. And meanwhile, they'll be building little rock walls, just like a person would.
They eat fish.
They will eat fish. They'll eat squid. They'll eat other octopuses. They will have that dinner date that you really wish you never had. I mean,
the ultimate dinner date.
Mating is a risky business, although it's also extremely erotic. I have to tell you, there's this great steamy sex scene in this book, which is unexpected. I was telling my friend Jody, we were on a train to New York, about these two octopuses mating, and suddenly I noticed that the car was utterly silent. Everyone in the train was listening, wondering what I was talking about. But I'm sorry.
Another reason to check out the book, The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness. So what, 50 Shades of Grey?
Right. Hey, 50 Shades of Grey with an octopus. It's 500 shades of the whole rainbow and a Kama Sutra of possibilities with no bones and, you know, six hearts beating as one.
And a lot of feeling.
Right, right.
Everywhere.
Eight arms and each with 1,600 suckers. Oh, my goodness. Think of the possibilities.
You know, you said that the reasons for an octopus's color changing, so many different colors are myriad. And I immediately thought of mood rings. And a little farther down in the paragraph, you mentioned that a lot of it could be mood, and there's protective. They change color, like kind of like camouflage.
Yes, they can camouflage. They can change color with emotion. The giant Pacific octopus turns red when it's excited, either excited, happy, or angry. And they'll turn white when they're really relaxed. There's other moods as well. And others who've observed octopuses trying to solve a puzzle, they love puzzles. They love manipulating objects. They love picking locks. But when they're doing it, when they're trying to decide, like, how do I do this, they'll often change color like a person might wrinkle their forehead or scratch their head or
bite their tongue.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They'll change colors.
And how many different colors?
Well, it varies with the species.
And it just goes – and it's not one color at a time.
No, no. They can grow spots. They can grow stripes. They can model – they can change the shape of their skin. They can grow enormous big bumps if they want. It looks like they have horns over their eyes. They can smooth themselves out like a balloon. And they can change their body posture to look like – now I'm a flatfish. No, I'm a whole bunch of snakes. Wait, no, I'm a shark. No, I'm something else. I mean, they can match their surroundings amazingly well. And in the back of my book, I list some videos that will just blow your mind, that the invisible octopus suddenly appears from nowhere, and it was sitting completely unseen on a clump of algae. So they can look like their background. But they don't just have to look like their background. They can look like anything as long as it's not an octopus in order to, one, escape their predators, and, two, confuse their prey. So they can scare their prey into appearing from a hiding place by pretending that they're something else. That's just amazing.
What was surprising, because it's not just one thing, but in the subtitle, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness. What did, for me, in reading about them in your book, everything surprised me because I was so pitifully ignorant, but I was more like most people.
No, I mean, no one knows about these things.
And it's really relatively recent that people, you know, even zoologists, people who in the zoos that take care of them, started to learn more about them and interact with them.
That's right. That's right. Because for many years, people were afraid of touching octopuses. They were also afraid that they might hurt the octopus.
Right.
So unlike at zoos, who for many years, like at the Columbus Zoo, there's a big thing about enrichment, we've heard. You know, you want the any of the primates to have stuff to do all day so they don't get bored and develop mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have nothing to do and you're bored literally out of your mind, you start to go crazy. No one thought about this for invertebrates. You wouldn't think like, gee, my invertebrate's getting bored. But people at New England Aquarium and now aquariums all over the world realize now how smart their octopuses are, and they've developed an enrichment manual so that your octopus doesn't get bored. And the thing is, a bored octopus is a dangerous thing because your octopus is going to come up with something to do that you don't like. And one of them might be to escape.
Uh-huh.
They're great escape artists. And when they escape, one, they could die, but two, they often get into neighboring tanks and eat the occupants. And you don't want that either. So you got to keep your octopus occupied.
What is it about their anatomy that allows them to basically go through a keyhole? I mean, I've seen some amazing videos. I'm exaggerating only slightly.
Well, very little. There are some who could go through a keyhole.
Yeah.
There's only one hard part in the octopus, and it's its beak. They have a beak like a parrot. And if your beak could fit through an opening, they can get through that opening. And there's some fun videos you can watch of them pushing themselves through. But they can basically pour themselves like water into a tiny crack or escape from. And this makes designing an octopus-proof tank very difficult because think of it. Every aquarium tank has to have tubes that connect it with, you know, the filtration system, and you've got to have fresh water coming through. And so those tubes have to exit your tank, and you got to make it so your octopus can't exit through that tube. And we had a very tragic incident that I record in the book of an octopus who we all loved very much, who got out and she died.
And you never really could figure out why she got out, because she didn't try to get into another tank or didn't appear to.
No. She was exploring. She was exploring. And my feeling is, although there are plenty of other tanks around, I think she hit the Vercon mat that disinfects everyone's shoes when you walk into the aquarium. But because their skin is so permeable, it's extremely sensitive. A molecule of copper, for example, will kill an octopus, even though their blood is copper-based. Octopuses can also choke to death on their own ink. Now, they wouldn't do that in the wild ocean because the ocean is constantly replenishing itself. But if you're in a tank or if you're in a plastic bag, which is how octopuses are transported by FedEx from one place to another, if that octopus gets upset and inks, it'll choke on its own ink and die. So they are very sensitive in that way. And I think it was this is just my theory, but I think it was chemical sensitivity that killed dear Kali, which was a horrible tragedy. She was a wonderful individual.
It was an irony, you said.
Yeah, it was, because, look, the octopus is such a smart creature and was so valued in that aquarium. And the fact that she died because she hit the Vercon mat, which is supposed to protect all of the animals from any kind of germ that we might be bringing in. It was a horrible irony. People at the aquarium, they love every single fish, every single anemone. A lot of them they've known since they were born or budded or hatched at the aquarium. And when you lose an individual, they all mourn.
Yeah.
And boy, you know, if there's reincarnation, I want to come back as someone who lives at that aquarium, because I know that I'm going to have a great life of terrific care with people who will love me. So it was a big tragedy for everyone at the aquarium to lose Kali.
We're talking about the New England Aquarium, plays a big role in Cy Montgomery's new book. It's called The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness. If you have a question or comment for Cy Montgomery, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out the Facebook page and post your question or comment there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the soul of an octopus with the author of a new book of the entitled. It's called The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness. And my guest is the prolific author and noted naturalist, Cy Montgomery. If you have a question or comment for Cy, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. She'll be at the Ohio State University Fawcett Center tonight for a Q&A and a lecture about her book and a book signing as well. If you have, you can check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. For most people, the octopus appears, you know, slimy and mysterious, but you say, and from reading your book, I believe you, they can be funny, adventurous, playful, very, very social. And that's not something they're necessarily with each other, but with humans, at least, you found that to be true.
Yes. And Dr. Roland Anderson, the late, alas, Roland Anderson, documented play in octopus scientifically. He documented an octopus who was playing with one of those, it was actually a Tylenol extra strength pill bottle, which, by the way,
childproof?
Yes, they can open those caps, by the way. So if you, you know, if you have arthritis or something, you need your home octopus to help you with that. But this octopus was using its funnel to shoot that into the water stream coming from the filter so that it would loop back to the octopus and it would use the funnel to shoot it again and again and again, just like a kid bouncing a basketball against a wall or playing catch. But I've had them play with me, and they love objects. They love to grab and play with objects. We had Wilson Menashe, an inventor and engineer, design these interlocking cubes. They're clear, so you put a treat for the octopus in the cube. The octopus sees the treat, and you have to unlock the box. Well, the octopus quickly learns to do that. You can put that box inside another box, which has its own different lock. So now the octopus has to unlock two different boxes. Then he invented another cube that had two locks. So the octopus would unlock four to get in there. And every octopus has that Wilson has known over 20 years has figured that out. And they enjoy it. If you give them something like a screw-top jar, they'll unscrew it to get to a crab or something inside. But often, just for yucks, they'll screw it back on. There was one octopus. There's one right now in New Zealand who loves to play with objects so much that they have taught her, her name is Rambo, to take photographs of the people who come to visit the aquarium. And the octopus will be presented with this tube that they thrust, Rambo thrusts her arm into this tube and presses the red button and takes pictures of patrons who are standing in front of a special background. And they charge for that, and they use the money for octopus conservation. It's pretty great.
Evan, you're on the air. Hi, Evan.
Hi. I was wondering if you can give a comparison of the mental maturity or intellectual development of an octopus in relation to a human child. It's often said that parrots achieve intellectual development that's equivalent to a human 2 or 3 or 4 year old. I wonder if you can give an equivalent comparison for an octopus.
Boy, I've heard those equivalences also, that, you know, and I've heard, you know, dogs and parrots. I think that octopuses are so alien that it's not possible to do that. There's a wonderful scientist who said to me, you know, if you were to compare humans and octopuses, the octopus might look at us and wonder how smart we were by asking, how many different colors can your severed arm turn in 7/10 of a second? And that's how different they are. So it's a really good question, but I don't think it's one that we can answer because they're so not comparable.
Yeah, that is a really interesting way to look at it.
And another thing is that a lot of times when we compare animals to children, you know, children are so interesting and we love them, but they are unfinished. You know, they are incomplete. They're on their way to being completed and turning into something else. Animals are finished and complete. And in a way, when we compare them to our children, when you compare a mature animal like an octopus to our children, it compares them to something that is lesser, in a sense, in many people's estimation, to an adult human. Farley Moat, the Canadian storyteller, uses the wonderful phrase, the more than human world. And maybe that's the case with octopuses. So they just defy that comparison that we're always looking for. And it's not a useless comparison. It's a good way of trying to understand the minds of others, but it might be kind of an incomplete way. So really, really interesting, good question. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you, Evan. Brad in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Brad.
Oh, hello. Hello, Cy Montgomery.
Hi, Brad.
I'm looking forward to your possible future book on squids.
Oh, my. Yes. That's moving up to two more arms.
Yeah. My question is, I love octopi also. And
it's octopuses.
Oh, it is octopuses.
Yeah. Believe it or not, I love saying octopi. Octopuses, your lips keep going. But they tell you it's octopuses because you can't put a Latin ending on a Greek word now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for that.
I learned it, too.
Yeah. It concerns me with the climate change and the acidification of the oceans and the effect on the corals, the health of the ocean species, not to mention all the species on the planet. What's the status and what's the prognosis for octopuses in the ocean?
Boy, I'm so glad you brought that up because it's messing up everything. I mean, climate change is messing up everything. And
water temperature is a big deal.
Oh, it totally is. And acidification is a dreadful thing for somebody whose skin is that permeable. And there's 250 different species of octopus, and we're discovering new ones all the time. One of the scientists I work with just discovered 5 new kinds off the coast of Brazil. We know so little, and we don't know how many of those might be severely endangered. A lot of them, we can't even find them.
Yeah.
Why? Because you look for them and they look like something else, or they've poured themselves down a hole. It's a big unknown. But what can be said for certain is that climate change is not going to benefit any of, you know, it's not going to benefit the sea. It's not going to benefit our world as we know it.
Brad, thanks a lot for that call. And Vince in Clintonville, I'm sorry about that. I think I hung up on Vince.
Oh, Vince,
sorry,
call back,
Vince,
please.
That was one of my just two arms did that.
That's right. If you had 8, this wouldn't have happened.
tell us, it's shocking to me how small they are born. And they're born in multiples. That came
100,000 eggs.
100,000 eggs in one birth. And the female doesn't. That's the end of her life.
Yes, but she cares for those eggs. And I had the amazing privilege. One of the octopuses who I knew and who was very friendly with me laid eggs while I knew her. And I had the privilege of watching her care for those eggs for 10 months.
And they do that at the expense of their own health.
Absolutely. They don't hunt. They never leave the den. Once they start laying eggs, they do not leave the den. And at the aquarium, we would offer Octavia food, and sometimes she would take it. We'd offer it on the end of a long set of tongs, but they wouldn't go out to hunt because they can't afford to leave those eggs, and they're very devoted mothers. And if they're lucky, they'll live long enough to use their funnels to help those paralarvae out of the eggs and push them out into the open sea.
And of those 100,000 or so, how many grow?
Well,
adults,
we'd be up to our necks at octopuses if it was
exactly
all of them. I mean,
so
one assumes that
very few.
Nature's balance would be 2.
Vince in Clintonville. Hi,
Yay,
Vince. Sorry
thank
about
you.
That.
Hey, Ann. Yeah, great show today, as usual.
Thank you.
I guess my thoughts about the whole show are, I've been enjoying it immensely, are that, you know, for so much of human history, we've just individuals and organizations, institutions, we've been walking the planet with all these stereotypes in our heads of what animals are based on very, very little information until recently. And still, I think that exists today. You know, people think, well, a dog can do this, a cat can do this, et cetera, et cetera. And I wonder if at some time in the near and distant future, a highly intelligent extraterrestrial species visits the Earth, and we humans are shocked to find out that they are far more interested in some other species on the planet than us, because they may have already seen what happens to self-destructive species. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Vince.
God, what a great observation. Thank you for calling back, Vince. Yeah. That's great. I agree with you. I totally agree with you. And, you know, if another species from outer space comes and sees us, I just pray they don't treat us as we have treated most of the other species through history.
You seem to enjoy observing the octopus's tank from the visitor section. Of course, you had incredible access to them behind the scenes, and that's a lot of what you base your book on and the stories that you tell about the octopuses that you became friends with. But you like to go to the other side and just to observe them from that point of view, probably too. But you also loved interacting with the people.
Yeah, and I was lucky.
You're like a little. You're like a little emissary out there.
The octopus ministry, right? Yeah. Well, what was so cool was some people love octopuses. Okay, I mean, it's considered the plum and the plum pudding of the aquarium. You really want to have an octopus because people adore it. Some people love them because they're scary monsters, and I loved seeing how people reacted to the octopus. And I loved seeing how they often changed their minds with just a little bit of information. There were these three teenage girls who came by, and they were looking at Octavia, who was tending her eggs. But they didn't see her eggs. They said, "Ew, ew, it's slimy. I bet it's gross if you touched it." And I was standing there, and I said, "But look. She's laid eggs. This is a mother octopus. And watch, she's tending those eggs really carefully, keeping them clean." And bam, like that, those teenage girls completely changed their view. And now they're like, "Oh, that's so sweet. And will those babies hatch? And what will happen?" And when I was telling people about eggs, they were very sad to learn that her eggs were infertile. Much like chickens, they lay infertile eggs. Octavia probably did not know, at least for the first few months, that her eggs were infertile. And of course, she'd never had a chance to observe her own mother because she had floated away as a paralarvae when she hatched. But it was moving to me to see particularly families who were distressed that her babies weren't going to hatch. They wanted for her the same joy that they'd enjoyed as a family. And one guy said to me, "You know, can't you get a dude octopus in here to help her out?" They really wanted the best once they saw her as an individual. And that's what I hope to do with this book, to show people these fantastic individuals so that they can see them as individuals and come to love them too.
Well, Cy Montgomery, thank you so much for sharing all the stories with us and for taking the time to write the book in the first place, because it's people like you that help bring us all closer to these worlds that we're so foreign to right now.
And people like you, Ann, I'm delighted to be on your show.
Cy Montgomery, prolific author, naturalist, world-renowned naturalist, and the author of a new book. It's called The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness. Once again, Cy will be speaking at the OSU Fawcett Center tonight. For more information about that, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer... All Sides interns Michael Hepburn, Shahina Sagiri, Ryan McFadden, Sam Buck, and Matt Berkeley, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.